You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 6 o'clock. Stay tuned for This Way Out. Tonight, in lieu of This Way Out, we're playing Raunch and Liberation. Two feminist authors, one from New York and one from Melbourne, Australia, observe and theorize about trends in sexual expression in the developed world. Ariel Levy, author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture, and Sheila Jeffries, author of Beauty and Misogyny, Harmful Cultural Practices in the West. And the host is and producer is Eleanor McInerney of Women on the Line. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Radio Cab Foundation, presenting its second annual benefit golf tournament Saturday, July 8th, 9:30 a.m. at Heron Lakes Golf Course. Proceeds go to assist hospitalized children and disadvantaged families in the metro area. Registration and prize information at radiocabcares.org. Also, Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. Keep in mind that the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Department needs more volunteers, needs people like you. So you should give us a call, and we'll let you know how you can come in and help create this programming. 503-231-8032. That's 503-231-8032. Ask for Lisa Loving. We'd love to hook you up. So here comes the Women's Informational News Gathering Service, Raunch and Liberation. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, Wings.
You reduce sexuality to breast implants and polyester underpants, then it's something to buy and sell.
We've got a prostitution culture that's being created for young women.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello and welcome to Women on the Line. I'm Eleanor McInerney, and I'll be with you on the program this week. Today we look at two recently published books examining the status of both women and feminism within a culture where beauty standards taking their cues from pornography have become widely disseminated and even celebrated. Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture by New York writer Ariel Levy, and Beauty and Misogyny, Harmful Cultural Practices in the West by Melbourne academic and radical feminist Sheila Jeffries, are two new works that consider this phenomenon and the unresolved conflicts in the women's movement over ideas of empowerment and sexual liberation. To begin with Ariel Levy, she was recently in Melbourne to promote her book, in which she dubs sexual exhibitionism women are increasingly engaging in as raunch culture, and examines how women seem to have become willing participants in their own objectification.
What I call raunch culture, women engaging in this, you know, it's a way to rebel against your mother, for one thing. Nobody wants to turn into their mother, and whether your mother is sort of a 70s feminist or a sort of right-wing Christian, I mean, this covers all the bases. If you're embracing strippers, you're going to piss off your mother. So, I mean, I think there's an aspect of that. And I also think that, I mean, in the United States anyway, and from what people have been telling me since I've been here, this has a lot to do with how commercial our culture is and how quick we are to commodify things. And, you know, we think we can sort of buy anything, including sexuality. And if you reduce sexuality to breast implants and polyester underpants, then it's something to buy and sell, and that's the end of the story. The idea that you have to do this to get power, I mean, I think it's about apologizing for how far we've come. I mean, I think women have obviously made enormous strides in society in an extremely short period of time, and there's still an incredible amount of anxiety about how do we reassure, you know, men, the people we're trying to declare our independence from, that we're still worth sleeping with. And I think it's a way to sort of say, you know, don't worry, you're going to have to compete with me at the office for a raise, and you're going to have to compete with me to get into college, but I still have a porn star buried within that. And that's something that's very formulaic. I mean, it's different than saying I have this authentic, passionate desire for whatever it is. It's this one thing that you can recognize and sort of know how to deal with, because it's going to be reiterated over and over again like a formula. Obviously, there are some women for whom this is authentic, and this is what they want to be doing, and this is real for them. And for them, I think, you know, this is great. You were lucky. You were sort of born at the right time. But I think if you just play the percentages and you think about how many ways there are to be sexual, it's just impossible that this is authentic for everyone, that this is the only thing that there is that's a real representation of female sexuality. So I just felt that it had become so ubiquitous, it started to seem more like an obligation than an option. And if it's not authentic, then it is about performance and not about pleasure, and that's no fun. Girls on Wild is this company they have in the United States where it's they sell tapes of footage of women flashing their breasts or their genitals or making out with each other. I mean, that's all, the whole tape, there's no plot, there's no, you know, that's it. It's just flashing, flashing, flashing. And the girls who are in it don't get paid. I went with them on spring break to watch this happen, that these guys walk around, they have a Girls Gone Wild t-shirt and a camera, and it's like they're snake charmers. It's what it seems like. I mean, women just come up and start flashing. So anyway, there was this 19-year-old girl at the back of a bar, and she had just taken off her clothes for them and simulated masturbation for the cameras. And like all the other girls, she didn't get paid. So I said to her, you know, what's in it for you? Why'd you do this? And she, you know, looked at me sort of blankly, and she said, the only way I can see someone not doing this is if they were considering a career in politics. And another girl I met on that same trip said to me, you know, it's like a reflex. It's like, you know, if you see it everywhere you look, you're going to think that this is just part of the job description for being female. This is what women do. A lot of teens said that at school dances and stuff, there was like a lot of lap dancing and a lot of girls making out with each other. And one girl said to me, it was a boy who said to me, I was trying to find that new way in, you know, like that new spin on it. How can I get the most attention? What can I do to distinguish myself as more raunchy, more willing, more wild than the next girl? And for women, your ability to attract attention is to present yourself as this one kind of exhibitionist. And it has to be, you know, you have to reiterate this shorthand for sexiness, to make yourself worth looking at. This isn't the same thing as vanity. I mean, I think that people have always, from the beginning of time, decorated themselves, and there's been a standard of beauty and, you know, Cole eyeliner and the Egyptians. I mean, I think people have always been interested in preening and walking around like a peacock and self-presentation. And so I'm not sure if they do that for each other or for themselves. I just think that with this one aesthetic that we're so focused on now, it's a rigidly specific message about sexuality that we expect all women to present, even when they're so young they don't even experience sexual feeling yet. I mean, that was my experience talking to these teenage girls, that often they didn't even think about sex, and already that was their big project, was how do I embody sexuality that I don't experience. People say all the time, well, how can this be happening? It's so antithetical to the rise of conservatism and the religious right. And I don't think it's antithetical at all. I think that they're reciprocal. 80% of the schools in the United States, the public schools that offer sex ed, teach abstinence only, which is to say, you know, they basically tell kids just say no to sex. And either they don't talk about contraception or they mislead kids about it and say, you know, that it's more ineffective than it actually is. Trying to restrict how much children understand about this fundamental part of their being. My point is just, when you have that much repression going on, I think it makes sense that people's sexual, you know, the way they're going to explode out in terms of sexuality is this over-the-top, raunchy, and again, very commercial, very formulaic, very non-threatening, because it always turns out the same way. Looking this one way and being a sexual human being, they're not the same thing. You know, the species has been recreating for some time before we had implants. But in terms of what people are willing to do to make that happen, I mean, the thing that depresses me the most is vaginoplasty, is this surgery people are having that's on the rise to have their labia corrected to look more like the genitals in porn. And, you know, doctors say all the time, it reduces your sexual pleasure. I mean, talk about putting performance over pleasure and appearance over authenticity. I mean, this is a way to actually hobble yourself out of having pleasure, and you do it in the name of being sexy. It's not just about women wanting to be accepted by men. I mean, in the lesbian community, you see a lot of the same concerns of, I mean, in the States anyway, that these ideas that, you know, gender is this sort of cartoonish thing, that either you're like a man and you're aggressive and you're adventurous and you're libidinous, or you're a girly girl, is what they say, or like a woman, which is to say like a cartoon woman with big cartoon breasts and long nails and just hyper feminine. It's interesting to me the way so many women I spoke to, straight and gay, were always saying, I want to be like a man, meaning, you know, obviously all these good things. And that's still a compliment. Oh, you write like a man. You know, you're as confident as men. There's this strategy that you see over and over again in different cultures, which is if you're not in power, you either have to act like the people in power or act like the people in power assume your group is. And I think that's what women are doing You know, I just feel compelled to say this because I'm so often, I've been on a show or radio or something and they say, you know, who's the worst? Is it Paris Hilton? Is it Pamela Anderson? Is it Jenna Jameson? I mean, that's no fun. I'm not interested in sort of saying, oh, this person's a dirty whore. It is your choice. And I would never presume to say to someone, you can't do this or, you're a bad person if you do this. I just think that it's also worth examining why we're doing it. And I don't, know sort of what percentage of it is imposed upon us. I mean, I think at this point it's like it's too late to sort of say this is men's fault because women have come too far. Women have too much power for that to make any sense. I mean, when I was with Girls Gone Wild, the person who was running the tour was a woman. You know, the CEO of Playboy is a woman. I mean, there's plenty of women in powerful positions making, raunch culture. So, and of course, participating in it and buying it, not just starring in it. So, I mean, I think at this point we're all in it together. And that's why I think that there's sort of no simple answer. It's just worth examining and thinking about other options. Is there an alternate sexuality that I sort of endorse or propose? No, because I think that sexuality is as wide-ranging as humanity. I mean, I think for every single person, it's its own thing. So there's no mold. I mean, that's sort of the point of this book, is that if we're holding up an ideal and it's like stripper, porn star, lusty, busty exhibitionist, that's no more inherently liberating than holding up a model and saying all women should be chaste and angels in the house. I think it should be whatever it is for you. I'm not trying to argue that every sexual encounter has to be in a soul-bonding context. I just think that there should be some emphasis on personal pleasure, and that if you don't have that, you can't possibly call it liberation, which is what we've done. I mean, I think that that's what's depressing about this, is we've pasted the lingo of women's liberation on putting on performances that have very little to do with self-gratification. The other perspective, that all this is fantastic and liberating and great, has been articulated so much already that I think people are sort of like, okay, we're ready to hear another point of view. It doesn't mean that this is the new sort of dogma, but you're allowed to say it once.
That was Ariel Levy, author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture, speaking at Dimmock's Bookstore in Melbourne. Sheila Jeffries is Associate Professor in the Political Science Department at Melbourne University. Her most recent work, Beauty and Misogyny, Harmful Cultural Practices in the West, examines the role of common beauty practices in the subordination of women and argues that these practices be included within the UN's understanding of harmful traditional and cultural practices. I began by asking Sheila what caused her to write this book.
I wrote it because I became aware in the late 90s that the beauty practices that women were required culturally to perform were really getting very savage and very severe compared with what I'd had to do in the early 70s. In 1973, on becoming a feminist, I actually gave up beauty practices. I'd previously done things like bleaching my hair, depilation, wearing makeup, and indeed high-heeled shoes, all of those things. But I gave them up on being a feminist, as many, many hundreds of thousands of women did. And it seemed, I think, through the 80s that it wasn't so necessary to engage in those practices. Women could actually wear comfortable shoes and have both feet on the ground and so on. But by the late 90s, vicious shoes had come back. And, of course, cosmetic surgery was becoming very much more severe, not just in the form of breast implants, which weren't happening when I was a young woman in the early 1970s, really, at all, but also there was labiaplasty, which was, created by the influence of pornography, which showed women with labia that had already been transformed because men apparently liked women's labia to look like the labia of babies or young children. So the practices were getting so severe, I felt something has to be done, and particularly I wanted this book, if possible, to reach a new young generation of women who are finding that they're having to engage in those practices and are starting to feel angry and resentful about it.
Do you think that it's also dangerous that this kind of thing is happening with greater regularity, especially for people who are younger, in the absence of a strong feminist critique in the popular culture?
I think that's right, and I think not surprisingly, when feminism has been very much under attack for some time, when there's not a strong women's movement, we're in one of those dips when there's not a strong feminist movement to identify with. So women are not receiving any contrary messages, in fact. If you just look at the magazine that comes with the newspaper at the weekend, there's picture after picture, several in each issue, of women with extraordinary torture shoes, and the shoes are getting higher and higher. But there's really no feminist messages out there at all for young women to identify with.
And in the book you argue that Western beauty practices qualify as harmful traditional cultural practices as defined by the UN. Why do you think it's important to situate them in this way?
Well, I teach international feminist politics, and so of course I'm very much aware of the importance of stressing women's rights as human rights and of the development of the concept, and it's been a very important concept that was developed in the 90s at the UN, of harmful cultural traditional practices. Now, that concept was developed to account for practices which are very harmful to women and girls, in fact, but don't fit into normal human rights understandings. And states that sign on to CEDAW, for instance, are supposed to try to change the attitudes that lead to such harmful practices. The paradigm case, of course, is female genital mutilation. But also there's things like son preference, the feeding up of girls before marriage, and there's a number of different practices. But those practices were seen as really happening in the non-West. It's almost as if, in the definitions of what is involved in harmful cultural practices, the West was not seen as having them really, because the West was seen as somehow not having a culture, which is something slightly backward, or the practices are justified by being fashion or individual choice. Whereas it seemed very clear to me that the practices women are expected to enact to represent femininity on their bodies are definitely harmful, certainly harmful to their physical health, and I suggest to their psychological health as well, and should fit within those understandings.
And you mentioned how these sort of practices are understood by many women as a result of choice. Feminism gave women empowerment and choice, and so now they're able to choose to wear makeup and things, whereas before there was a strong feminist critique against such things. I think you talk about relentlessly positive postmodern view of how women and girls engage with popular culture. Why do you think this sort of view doesn't really talk about the basis on which women are expected to engage in these kind of practices?
I think that there were two attacks on the feminism that had criticized beauty practices that were happening in the 90s. One was indeed what I call the relentlessly positive postmodernism, which said they've got to talk about women's agency, and you mustn't talk about women being oppressed, and you mustn't talk about the cultural weight upon women to make them do things, but they're all expressing their agency. And I think that that has made life very difficult for young girls. And of course there was liberal feminism becoming very strong in the 90s, which criticized the feminism of the 70s and said that actually now women know that they've got a choice, because they've gained so much from feminism, they can go back to wearing what their mothers rejected, which was the lipstick and so on, and do it out of choice. But I think a good response to this, apart from the fact that, of course, feminism hasn't yet achieved its aims at all, and women are still enormously subordinated in all kinds of ways, I think we have to ask why men don't make this wonderful choice. You know, if it's about choice, men are in a position to make it. They can choose the pain of wearing high-heeled shoes. They can choose to ingest the toxic chemicals that are in lipstick and wear it every day. They can choose not to go out of the house until they've transformed their appearance and put a mask on, and so on and so on. But surprisingly, men don't make that choice. So actually, nothing has changed. It was never a choice for women. It's a part of women's subordination. It's what I call in the book the sexual corvée. Like peasants in medieval Europe had to spend part of the week working on the lord's land for nothing in order to have the right to have their own subsistence and a bit of land for themselves, the sexual corvée is required in Western culture of women. If they want to go out in public, if they want to be in the workplace in particular, in order to have the right to do that and earn their own livings and walk on the street and be in the public sphere, they have to spend enormous amounts of time and energy transforming themselves in order to be sexually attractive to men, in order to have the right, the citizenship rights of getting out on the street or being in the workplace. Men don't have to do any of those things.
Do you see that there is this pressure to go along, to get along?
Oh, absolutely. I think that women are engaging in these practices because that is the only way that they feel that they can gain social approval at this time. So we haven't done very well with the idea that women would have the same rights and privileges as men to be judged for their brains, for their strength, for what they can do in their world, for their talents and so on. We've got a prostitution culture that's being created for young women, in which they're being restricted to particular kinds of bodies and particular kinds of acts they do and how much they sexually excite men. I think we're at a very extraordinary moment, in fact.
On community radio around Australia, you're listening to Women on the Line. I have been speaking with radical feminist academic Sheila Jeffrey about her most recent book, Beauty and Misogyny, Harmful Cultural Practices in the West. So we'll now move on to a discussion of the similarities between Sheila's work and Aria Levy's Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. There is another book out at the moment called Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. And I just thought there was a striking similarity in some of the issues discussed in both books, because in your book you're arguing that ideologies of beauty and fashion, such as those circulated through popular culture, do subordinate women, however passionately those women may adhere to them and cut their bodies up in response. And this seems to be a similar argument that Aria Levy, the writer of Female Chauvinist Pigs, is making. Do you think there are many similarities in both works?
There are many similarities. I think that the book is really important for young women right now, because what it's showing is the, as my book tries to do as well, the impact of pornography, which has been completely normalized over the last 20 years, and the impact of the sex industry, and the way that these industries of the subordination and abuse of women have actually affected popular culture, entertainment industries, the music industry, and become so normalized that, in fact, as Levy explains in her book, women are actually seeking to form themselves into porn models. It's become the new cultural ideal for women that they should actually represent themselves as porn models and be prepared to do for nothing, you know, forms of pornography, to be on television programs without actually being paid. And of course there are women who are somehow seeing that, as she explains, as being connected with sexual freedom, which is completely extraordinary. Men are not showing their anuses for nothing in order to get on the television and so on. I mean, that's not what's going on out there. It's just the ordinary traditional subordination of women, which I think is actually a kind of compensation to men for the gains that women have made, because they certainly have. Since the 1970s, women have got into all kinds of occupations. They have made gains. And the men have to be compensated for the loss of power and status that otherwise they could face in that situation. And it seems to me that the compensation is the massive development of the sex industry, which has become just such an enormous part of culture. You know, the advertisements that women have to walk past on the street every day, what they see in magazines for young girls that teach them how to do anal sex and sexually service men as if they were in the sex industry, and so on.
Do you think that this new feminism looks sexy but actually doesn't promote women's sexual pleasure and power?
I have to say that a lot of this so-called new sexy feminism is actually about prostitution. Prostitution's been about servicing men sexually when it was nothing to do with the pleasure or personhood of the woman who was doing that. And that's what the new sexy feminism is about. She makes it clear, as do many other sociological studies of young women and sexuality at the moment, interestingly enough, that what women are doing is very hard work. They're having to do practices like anal sex that are absolutely nothing to do with their pleasure. They're having to do oral sex on men, which is not about the women's pleasure. They're having to do servicing practices, which are often painful and unpleasant. They're not encouraged to think about their own bodies or their own pleasure. So we've actually got the creation of a generation of young women who are actually having to service men in the practices of prostitution, although they're not generally getting paid for that. It's a very, very far reach from in the 1970s. In 1974, in Britain, where I was at the time, we developed a new demand, as it were, of the women's liberation movement. We had seven demands, and it was a self-defined sexuality for women. Now, that, we thought, was tremendously important in 1974. We're now so far away from it, it's impossible to imagine we ever had the naivety and optimism and ambition to have such a demand. So we've gone from the state which we were, I think, in 74, where supposedly women weren't even regarded in sexual relations with men as anything other than a body simply to be used, to the situation in 2005, where young women not only have to be used, but they have to perform all of the tricks of the trade of prostitution and pornography in order to sexually excite men. So we've moved into a different stage. But the self-defined sexuality of women has never had anything to do with it. As Aria Levy makes clear, it's not about enjoying sex for women. It's about servicing the men and therefore trying to gain some kind of status and be approved of in a society in which gaining status in the eyes of men and servicing them is enormously important. So, no, I don't think at all that this is something that women do for themselves.
Levy also makes the point that these role models, being people who are in pornography and often are in a highly proportionate population of sexually traumatized women, do you think this celebration of the look is also concealing the violence that a lot of people experience in these industries?
There's no question that prostitution in general, particularly in the form of pornography, is extremely violent. Aria Levy talks about Jenna Jameson, the top porn model, who talks about the the violence that happens to her. And in her book, she says that, you know, she's made to cry by the pain she experiences, and then the camera zeroes in on the tears, because that's what the pornography is about, and that's what pornographers want, and that's what turns on the customers who buy the pornography. And very often there is a strong history of sexual abuse in childhood, gang rapes and so on in teenage years, in the backgrounds of these women who are then turned out into pornography. And often in the States, if you read the magazine of the pornographers online, Adult Video News, they've got a section called Fresh Off the Bus. The girls are going into pornography as soon as they can. They're supposed to be 18, but I'm sure many go in younger. They've had no other kind of work experience in their lives, but what I think they have had is experiences of poverty and abuse. When they're in that industry, they can sometimes be, you know, on set for hours and hours. They have to take lubricants, they have to take painkillers, they have to take muscle relaxants and drugs to cut off so that they're not actually experiencing what's going on. The practice is an extraordinarily violent one. So that is now the cultural model according to which young women are supposed to fashion themselves. And that is a pretty extraordinary situation.
You have written also about queer politics. I believe he talks about raunch. It's also being embraced by lesbian communities in America. What did you make of her findings?
Well, I do write about the phenomenon of female-to-male transsexualism happening amongst young women. That's a cult of it seems to have happened in the 90s amongst some young lesbians. In the 70s, lesbian feminists like myself, we fought against the idea that to be a lesbian you had to be either masculine or feminine, and you didn't have to behave in roles. That was what heterosexuals did. You didn't have to do any of that. But in the tremendous backlash against feminism, when masculinity has become such a powerful value, I mean, it always has been, but culturally it's so dominant and so held up, in the 90s we did get the development of lesbians being prepared to try and become masculine and even go to the extent of having hormones that are extremely harmful to their health, the hormones, or mutilating surgery, removing parts of their bodies, castrating them in order to try and make them like men. And Levy does explain that when lesbians are doing this, very often they adopt the language and the attitudes towards women that men in ordinary masculine culture do, and those are abusive attitudes. But I think we need to understand, and she doesn't say so much about this, that actually those young women who are moving in that direction are doing so because there's no place for lesbians. There's no positive way still to live as a lesbian. So it's important to recognize lesbian oppression and how the surgery, for instance, the transgender surgery some of these young women are going to, is like what historians of lesbianism described in the 1950s, where lesbians and gays would supposedly choose, because they were so horrified at their lesbianism or gayness, to go into mental hospitals and then actually have surgery on their brains to try and make them straight. Well, transgender surgery, of course, makes lesbians straight. It actually eliminates lesbianism, both of them and of their partners, and turns them into straight couples. So we're in a terrible time of backlash against lesbianism as well.
You mentioned that there's no positive way to be a lesbian in culture and society, but I'm wondering which ways there are to be positive as a woman, and do you think that this requires not engaging in beauty practices, even if women find enjoyment in them as a form of creative expression? Do you think they fundamentally just promote the view that women's bodies in their natural state are inferior?
I think that there's very positive ways that one can be women presently and be lesbians. But in the popular culture, those positive ways are not promoted to women. So certainly one can positively be a lesbian and have, you know, very positive networks and very positive life, and so can heterosexual women. But that's difficult because the popular culture is not offering models in order to do that. The backlash against radical feminism is because it's too dangerous for women to be radical feminists. I mean, the students that I teach tell me, you know, because they often develop very strong feminist ideas, they tell me how difficult it is to talk to their boyfriends, their male friends, people they know. It's just so incredibly difficult to have those ideas about any kind of self-definition of one's own needs and interests and sexuality for young women. They find it frightening to do that. And it is very frightening to do that. You get socially punished. And we're in a backlash time politically on all kinds of fronts, but also towards women as well, where it's very dangerous for women to stand up for themselves in those ways.
That was Sheila Jeffries from Melbourne University.
You know my sisters.
And that's all for Women on the Line today. Women on the Line is Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs program. It's produced and presented by a range of women broadcasters from 3CR in Melbourne and distributed nationally via the Community Radio Network Service of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. If you'd like to contact the producers of Women on the Line, email to women_onTheLine@yahoo.com.au. The theme music for Women on the Line is Kerri-Ann Cox's She's Got a Story Too. I'm Eleanor McInerney. Hope you can tune in again next week.
You can hear this program and others again in the web archive at www.wings.org. Thanks to our supporters, including Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of Il Dono, The Gift. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.